to just bring up before we close the use of automation at Sigma Sound. Memory's Little Helper, which you talk about on your website and the board.
Yeah, well, in the, I guess the early 70s, everybody was talking about, and every manufacturer had some device that was the supposedly going to assist in mixing a record. Hard thing about that, you know, as you record it multi-track, you developed a list of tasks that you had tried to perform in that 3.5 minutes or whatever the length of the record was. You know, there's a bass note that's bad. We're going to mute the bass there. And we're going to bring these two words up in the vocal to get lost, and so forth and so on. A whole myriad of ride the strings here, get the guitar lick, so when you were doing a mix, you know, the assistant had his hands on the board, you had your hands on the board, the producer, everybody had a job to do. And you could do that 20 times and not get it right and go on forever. So here's automation that allowed you to build a mix that you could fix the vocal, go back. And so manufacturers started to come out with these automated devices or boards. They weren't even boards then, they were devices that you added to a board. And none of them really worked. I hooked up with a company that it was Allison Research, and which came out with a device called Memory's Little Helper. And it was an analog system that went down and looked at the favorite positions and recorded it, and recorded that information on a track of the 24 track. So it required two tracks of data, one to bounce to, so you wound up with 22 tracks instead of 24. To make a long story short, every time you made a pass, there was a little bit of a time lag. So, I mean, it was a very slow system, but it worked. So that you would do a tight punch where you're going to take out a bad note or a noise or a click. And if you mixed too many times, that click would start to appear because the window kept shifting. But it did work, and I would say to you, to the best of my knowledge, Sigma's was the first studio in the world to have a successful working automation system. And when I opened my studios in New York in 1976, no one wanted to use none of the New York people, the engineers and the other studios, wanted to hear about automation or wanted to use it because it was too foreign to them. And we had been using it for 4 years already. So that's the story about Memory's Little Helper.
You talked about a track that might show, have an example of it. Was it Message in Our Music, or was it Do It Any Way You Want It?
Well, Do It Any Way You Want It was a record that was recorded in a completely different style, and a completely different.
Just a minute of it? 13. Just a minute. Tracks get longer in this era.
When he asked about automation, that was a group called People's Choice. And People's Choice, that recording, we made the recording, and the company didn't think too much of it, and I don't think it was going to be put out. And I really liked something about it, and I played it for a guy named Tom Moulton. And Tom Moulton is should be here because he's sort of like a record historian and a person that was originally a writer for Billboard magazine and did the dance column and eventually started to remix records and do club mixes and responsible for the term remixer. And I played it for him, and I said, I really think this record could be something. And we took that record down to the basic intro that was just drums and bass and reworked it with automation and completely changed the structure of the record, and it went out and became a pretty big hit. While that is a version, that is not, it is not the version that was the single. It's close enough to get my point across, but it really proved to me the power of automation, because we took this very complex, almost boring song, and through the expertise of Tom Moulton, took it down to its basics and then rebuilt it. Today, that's done all the time. I mean, today a producer makes what they call beats. And they put lyrics on top of it, and some guy that knows what he's doing on the West Coast or whatever mixes it, and he really, really takes the basic elements and makes a new record out of it, and they call that, you know, a remixer.
Remix.
So that's I think that automation is a great thing. However, it was supposed to save time. It was supposed to give you an end, but the more options you give a creative person, the more options he wants. Never wants to make his mind up, never wants to say that's it, always wants to save that to the very end. So today we take a half a day to get a bass drum sound. True.
That's a good question. I mean, the company, Atco Records, owns all the masters. Yeah, and I talked to him last year. He says, this spring I'm putting it out, and this is almost summer now, you know, so who knows, you know. It's a shame because it's all sitting in the bins there, you know. I mean, he cost me a lot of money, let's put it that way.
That's a very strange story. I mean, that whole catalog, a lot of it's been re-recorded. Yeah, but not the originals.
Not the originals, no.
Yeah, because Bobby Rydell and Chubby Checker both have ongoing careers, and they have to have new material to present to their audience.
Yeah. Well, I think he should be sued for denying him the exploitation of their work.
I had a question over here first. He hasn't asked one.
How great. Oh, well, I mean, listen, you could, this is the way it worked when I worked at Cameo, when I worked for Dave. You'd go in the studio on a Monday, cut a track, put the vocals on Tuesday, send it to New York on Wednesday to get strike offs, and Friday have it on the air if you knew the right disc jockey and you did the right thing. So, and today, all that's gone because, you know, we have these homogenized playlists. I think it's terrible, but independents will find a way. There'll be pirate radio or something, because, you know, we can't deal with this vanilla homogenized.
So it's true that it was good then, it's bad now.
Yeah. Well, for the independent guy to break in, and look, the success of record companies, the success of our industry, the success of creativity has always been the little independent guy. You know, I mean, the Beatles, Maverick was Madonna. I mean, Madonna was Sire Records.
Right.
I mean, you look, and most of the new waves in music come from somebody. Sun Records comes from some guy in his basement. Does not come from the big corporate where they want to play it safe all the time.
We have a question over here.
I heard a
Well, there was a compliment. The string contractor, we had a contractor for strings and horns with the, Don Rinaldo, who basically played violin in supper clubs and so forth for a living as a, but and he handpicked the musicians. Some of them played for the orchestra, and some, you know, were played the theaters in town. And I got to tell you one quick story, and because it, you know, we're working on a thing similar to the Standing in the Shadow of Motown called the United the Philadelphia Story. I don't know if it's going to happen, but we're working on it. But in I think it was 1969-70, we were in Kenny Gamble and Leon and Tommy took a group of musicians to Washington to perform at a black writer, radio and television announcers convention, performers convention. And it was called NATRA. And a busload of musicians who eventually became MFSB. And we put on a show with the OJs and Jerry Butler, and great show. And a guy comes up to Kenny Gamble and he says to him, "Hey man," he says, "how come so many of the guys in the band are white?" And Kenny turned around and he said, "My color's not white, my color's not black, my color's green." And I thought he said it perfectly, and that was the, you know, and one of the reasons if we do this program, it's going to be called United, because his music was really, in the early 60s, it was still a very segregated society, and in the studio, there was no segregation. It was fantastic. I think it's a reality of business. I was never connected. I mean, I was never exposed to that side, but I think it's the way people do business. And I mean, I think it's a reality of life that in the music business it's called payola, but it goes on in the halls of Congress every day. Right, they call it lobbying.
Mm-hmm. Lobbying.
I wish. I'm waiting for it. Yeah. Well, I'm with Dave, and then we're going to wrap it up.
You answered my question indirectly. I wanted to ask if there was any bass at all on the pistol stomp, and you confirmed that there isn't.
No bass, just bass drum. Bass drum, maracas, and a guitar.
Any particular decision?
Well, the reason we did that, we originally got, there was a record that they were playing up in Bristol, you know, a little one of those hops. I can't even think of the name. Students, was that the name of the group or something? I've even forgot the name of the song, but that was the feel that record had, you know, just music-wise, not the song, I'm talking about music. So Cal and I wrote the song called, you know, Bristol Stomp, because the record started up, that sound started there. And it was just a bass drum. What else? Well, it had a bass drum, there was a snare on it, you know, but it was a bass drum, no bass, just bass drum, and maracas and a guitar. Joe Scro was the, I don't know if you remember the name Joe Scro, he was the guitar player on it.
Was that Everyday
Blues? It might have been, yeah. That was the song, I think. Yeah.
In the 1980s, and this is just informal feedback, musicians in the rock underground in the Midwest, the so-called punk rock scene, really admired that record a lot.
Because that bass drum was what they use today. You know, a lot of rock bands today, you don't even know there's a bass there. That bass drum is important, you know, very important.
Joe has something to share with us.
Well, when I left the studio to come here today, before I left, I wanted to go in and count the options on SSL input strip that the engineer had at his disposal to alter the sound on one track. One track, and I counted over 150, either switches, knobs, you know, rotary controls, switches with knobs with switches in them, and so forth, 150. So, and this is a module from the original Sigma console, which has two equalizer knobs with selector buttons for frequency, one send, which means you can only have one echo chamber or one set of earphones out in this, one mix to earphones out in the studio, and a trim for the microphone input, and the volume control. So this is the simplicity that the records that Dave and we work with in the 60s and 70s.
I'm gonna have to wrap it up here, just because one more question. You haven't asked one. And then...
Well, mine is a slightly long question, and I connected with your remarks about the room in which the recording was made. Some years ago, in our meeting, we met in Rochester, and there was one of the sound engineers from Mercury Records who described how they made the records. This is classical music in the auditorium of Eastman School of Music. Mercury Records owned three microphones. Two of them were stereo set up and one per model. In the Eastman Hall, they had a hole in the ceiling through which they would lower one of the microphones to the spot that they had found in the auditorium, and that was all the setup they had. The orchestra would play and they would record. Now, this is the room that they had found, and that was the number of microphones that they needed. I wonder if anybody has tried such a thing with the more popular music, because from what I hear, they're over engineered, over equipment, and to the extent that
there's no question about it that the music, that the pop music is really a creation made in the studio. It is, today it relies less and less on acoustics of a space. We're lucky. George Blood is here, who records the Philadelphia Orchestra, and he's done a recording for me at Lincoln Center in New York. And he did it with two microphones, and I've been involved in some binaural recording with the head with the ears in it, and it's amazing. The BBC did a test, and I'll get off this, but the BBC did a test where they did a multi-track recording of a symphony orchestra, and they did a stereo recording of the same orchestra, and they conducted a survey, and the stereo recording won hands down. So it gives you some idea of what a room means and just good technique with microphones. Thanks.
So I recommend everybody go home and listen to The Intruders, Jerry Butler, and Delphonics, and Teddy Pendergrass, and thank these guys, and the Bunny Hop, and some of these things. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
I think we have a break till 3:30, is that right?